Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Shout out to our super producer, Max Williams, who is on vacation and is going to send me some out-of-context photos at some point. Everybody get ready. I'll update you if they're safe for work. Big shout out to our returning guest producer, the one and only Mr. Lowell Brilliante, also the creator of the Prodigy podcast. Check it out as soon as you get a chance, but don't check it out just yet. Check it out after you listen to today's episode, where I am joined with a returning special guest for their third time on the show. Fellow Ridiculous Historians, you know him as the creator of the soundtrack of this show. You know him as the creator of Ephemeral, one of the best podcasts out there, neck and neck with Prodigy, in my opinion. Please join me in welcoming back Alex Williams.
You guys do the best. I mean, you do the best introductions. I was going to say you guys, but Noel's not here.
Noel is on adventures, separate adventures from Max. That's my ride or die co-host, Noel Brown. We are doing this with his blessing and adoration of you, at least. He will be returning soon. But yeah, you are our draft pick. You are the one person out of all 12 friends that Noel and I have. And out of those 12, out of the 5 that were available, you were the one who said yes.
You know, it's nice to be on a list of any size or kind.
Right. That's what the NSA is always telling me. Yeah. So, Alex, this is, as you know, we talked off air, this is one of my favorite times of the year, because we are hurtling toward the end of the calendar, and on the way, we're going to hit Halloween. Were you ever a big Halloween guy? You're also, since you're Max's older brother, I have to ask, were you guys like Halloween kids?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we grew up in the suburbs. I don't know if that meant, but I've, you know, like trick-or-treating, mm-hmm. you know, door-to-door, sort of neighborhood block party style, haunted houses in the neighborhood. My birthday's in October, October 4th. I'm all fall, all Halloween, ever since I can remember, still there.
Nice.
Yeah, all about it.
Nice. So you are eminently qualified for this. That's eminently with an EM, not like immediately about to be qualified, just because this is an audio show. So we talked off air, you and Lowell and I, about some, I don't want to say Halloween-y, but no, keep it. We can keep that,
right? I kind of like Halloween-y. I've sort of come around on that one.
Okay, so some Halloween-y stories we wanted to explore. And one of the ones that we're diving into this week on this episode is about vampires. It's about New England. It's about panicking.
Yes, it is. I just want vampire jokes, Ben. I don't know if I have a whole bunch prepared.
Okay.
I was going to say something like, oh, Noel's not, you know, here because I, you know, what was the word? Exsanguinated?
Yes.
Bit into his neck and exsanguinated
mm-hmm.
him.
Mm-hmm. To drain one of the blood. Alex.
If I had really thought ahead, bro, I would have brought those little plastic vampire teeth with me. And I would have totally like not smiled at you or talked to you until we got in here. And I would have just been like, harsh, smashed around the show.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, some people think vampire jokes are a pain in the neck, but I dig them because my bar for comedy is like way low.
I've been thinking about vampires so much today, but I think literally any vampire pun is going to get me.
Oh, fantastic.
Be warned. Well,
okay, yes. Also, tell me if we need to dial it back, because I got vampires on the mind as well. So when we talk about vampires today, what do we usually think about, Alex? Like, what do you think is...
Eastern Europe,
okay.
You know, olden times, like medieval times.
Fangs.
I think of Vlad the Impaler.
Yeah, Vlad,
right?
Tepish, yeah.
If we're going to go, like, literal, though, And we could get into that if you want. I it seems like the connection between Vlad the Impaler and Dracula and the whole vampire myth is maybe kind of over-exaggerated in popular consciousness. What else do you think of, like castles?
Castles, yeah. Unnecessary capes that they can still sort of pull off.
What would you call an unnecessary cape? I mean,
well, I, you know,
what's a necessary cape?
A necessary cape is when it's cold out and you don't have other kinds of clothing. Or I would say a necessary cape, if you're a kid and you're playing superhero, you need a blanket like that defines your character.
Capes often go on flying figures that fly, superheroes,
yes.
And vampires fly sometimes.
Sometimes the rules aren't clear. What is interesting is that what you describe perfectly, like immortality, maybe some heliophobia, these kinds of things all sort of coalesce in our idea of the modern vampire. But as you know, if you look back across the span of human civilization, different cultures around the planet, you'll see something like a vampire exist in folklore. And often, I don't know, maybe I'm being like a grass is greener on the other side of the grave guy, but I feel like a lot of other cultures have more interesting ideas of vampires. Or pre-Bram Stoker, there was a lot more variation in the idea. But today, you and I are going to talk about when this folklore had some very real, quite grotesque consequences for the people of early New England.
You're talking about when Mel Brooks made with Leslie Nielsen, Dracula Dead and Loving It?
Yes, yeah, which I count as early New England.
Wait, what am I here for? No, yeah, with it.
Yeah, so when we think of New England, early New England, people often think of things like the Salem witch trials. They think of Puritans. They think of the Crucible. But they don't think of a vampire panic. If we were to paint this scene of early life in, let's say, the 1700s in New England, then we'd see it's a pretty brutal life, right? It's not unusual for people to starve to death. The colonists are having conflicts with indigenous people. People are struggling to grow food in an unfamiliar climate. And there's disease like everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I was lucky enough to work on a show called Unobscured in its first season. I still work on it, but in its first season, it was all about the Salem witch trials. And we got to interview all these great eminent historians that have done really incredible work about it. And it's really interesting. It's just like a few months in 1692. But yeah, everything you said, I mean, it was super hard. The war is going on all the time between native peoples and the colonists. And like, you know, I think there's this idea that, you know, at least this is, I feel like the idea that I walked away from, like, you know, maybe primary school with, that like, it's like, oh, these sort of Puritans, like, you know, these pilgrims fled the old world for like religious persecution, and they came here and they got to practice it, and it was super nice. But really, people had very strong opinions here and very different opinions, and that led a lot to sort of where people settled. And so, like, the differences between different towns, even within Massachusetts, the difference between Rhode Island and Pennsylvania, and the difference between Vermont and Connecticut was often like very sort of fertile ground for disagreements of all kinds.
Yes, yeah, especially when you consider that for people in the secular world, or even for people who consider themselves religious in the modern day, some of these doctrinal differences might seem relatively, like not too crazy. Can't we all just get along? But for these folks, they were hard enough limits to make visiting another area or another community feel almost as though one were traveling to a foreign country. And culturally, in some ways, you can see how people would feel that way, because these are folks immigrating from various parts of Europe, right, over time. So you're right. This was not as hunky-dory as many public schools taught us. It was quite the opposite. This episode owes a lot to a retired state archaeologist in Connecticut named Nicholas Bellantoni. He put some time into kind of characterizing just how bad mortality rates were in New England between 1786 and 1800. 1786 is when health officials first started saying, we should figure out how many people are dying each year. I swear there were more people at the last Christmas party.
Yeah.
You know, I know that sounds cold, but when they calculated this, they said that for tuberculosis alone, 2% of New England's population went down because of that. They died. And they didn't call it tuberculosis at this point. They called it
consumption.
Consumption.
I have not heard or seen a reasonable explanation of why it was called consumption. It's just not a term that I really use or hear today at all, consumption in any context besides like eating, consuming something.
I think that's what I always assumed. I don't have a hard and fast answer for that, but I always assumed it was called consumption due to the weight loss that a lot of people encounter during tuberculosis.
Oh, like the disease is consuming you.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, it was the way that you mimed that just clarified it for me, which I noticed didn't translate into audio. But okay. I get it. Consumption.
Yes.
It's not so much, because I would think, you know, I always hear that, you know, consumption is about eating, but I'm like, but if you're getting skinnier, if you're wasting away.
Right.
But you are being consumed. The disease itself is the consumption.
It's out to get, you're the one on the menu. Yeah, this is, and later in, 1882, a Dr. Robert Koch will announce that he has discovered the bacteria that causes tuberculosis. And
basically, no one listens to him.
No, of course. Who listens to doctors?
Germ theory was not very popular, as I understand it, when it came out. People were like, what are you? There is not little entities living all over the place. It's magic, like it's always been.
It always has been, yeah. And that reminds me of the story of Semmelweis, the one guy who said, hey, everybody, maybe we should wash our hands. Since we're doctors, maybe we should just scrub our hands with a little. I didn't even have to be soap. Just run some water over them before we stick them inside people. And they were like, this guy is an ass. Lock him up.
They put him in an institution,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
You know how I learned that? It's not a spoiler. They say it in Midnight Mass in one of these long monologues in Midnight Mass.
Oh, yeah. I love Midnight Mass.
I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Mm, it's not without its problems, but maybe we won't include me saying that because I don't want to get flack.
From Midnight Mass?
From fans of it.
Oh, no. I think people would agree. But speaking of problems, consumption.
Yes, right.
You like the segue? Consumption is a problem here. We've got a quote from Bellantoni who says, this death toll, referring to New England, is not only terrifying, it's also a horrific way to die. Consumptives lost weight, they coughed up blood, their skin turned ashen, and sometimes they died a slow death, almost as if, Lowell, if we could get a creepy sound cue here, someone was sucking the life out of them. And like you set us up perfectly here, Alex, this is before germ theory. Even the learned men of the day, the physicians, aren't sure how to really explain how infectious diseases are spread. And because no one had an explanation, people started thinking through like their own ideas of what this could be.
Yeah. You know, one other thing that's really kind of terrifying that I didn't realize about tuberculosis or consumption, I'm going to just call it consumption.
It sounds classier.
It's really creepy. It's a really well-named disease. Now that you've made it so, you've illustrated it so well for me. But one of the things that I learned, and when you sort of read on this subject, you hear this name Michael Bell a lot. Michael Bell, it seems to be, is like the guy who really has connected tuberculosis, the awful, I mean, tuberculosis being the leading killer of people in New England at this time, and this particular panic that we're talking about today. But one of the things that I learned from him is that tuberculosis or consumption could be very slow acting. It could come on and then it could go dormant and it could rest dormant in you for years and then suddenly could come back. people. And also, you know, it was sort of a selective killer, it seems like. Like people in close quarters, you know, it would spread like a wildfire from one family member to the next. But then someone in the family might just not get it, or maybe they carry it for a long time and it wouldn't affect them till later. It has some eerie parallels to coronavirus, obviously, and just the way that you like don't know when it's going to strike, but you know it's sort of in your midst.
It's out there. Yeah. And that's an example of this would be perhaps the life of Doc Holliday, as played by Val Kilmer in Tombstone, which is not super accurate, but he has traveled as a consumptive to a different environment, with the hope being that a different climate will help him survive tuberculosis. A lot of people in New England at this time, they didn't have that option. They couldn't say, summer in Greece or whatever. You know what I mean? They were like trying not to cough blood on whatever they were growing, or, you know, the kids they're trying to feed. And you described something that I think is incredibly important here, Alex, the paranoia this kind of thing can create, because you are probably living in close quarters with people. A lot of folks, the family is living in a small structure. They're not able to effectively quarantine. If they practice some concept like that, in many cases, just living in the same home in these small structures was enough for the disease to spread throughout the entire family. But not only would it maybe play ball sometimes and then go dormant and then go back on its game over years, not only would that occur, but people couldn't predict it.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't know. Someone, you would think you were fine, and then you would start wasting away, but it had been several months after a relative had died. That's just when your tuberculosis, for some reason, went active. And that's what they talk a lot about, or health experts and historians talk a lot about tuberculosis in terms of latency and active, like latent tuberculosis, dormant or active. And at some point, anywhere between 70 to 90% of the population of the U.S. had either latent or active tuberculosis. Nowadays, as you know, if you're listening, we figured out, we the human species, not Alex Lowell and I, figured out that tuberculosis is spread through the air. So just like with COVID, remember, did you ever go out during the pandemic and accidentally cough somewhere?
Yeah. I feel like I coughed in the office today a few times, and I feel like everyone was staring at me, even though there was four of you here. Like, I could spread tuberculosis to you. I thought we said we were going to call it consumption.
I could
consumpt you from here.
Yes, yes. One could be consumpted, which I think we should use instead of consumed.
Well, yeah, clearly.
Consumed is at the end. You're consumpted at the beginning. Yeah, it's true. But because people didn't have the benefit of germ theory, they weren't sure what caused it. And they weren't sure, more importantly, how to stop it. And in places like Lynn, Massachusetts, this consumption, whatever it is, becomes the leading cause of death. We mean entire families are gone. They're, as the more dramatic would put it, their bloodline has been erased, consumed. And no one could figure out what happened, why people would suddenly get this incredibly unpleasant death sentence. And if we go back to Michael Bell, who really did write the book on this. He's the guy. He points out some differences between COVID-19 and consumption. He says one of the primary differences is that it is, like you pointed out, Alex, it's much slower to manifest, and it doesn't explode through a population. And when something explodes through a population, it'll leave behind people who were either lucky or had some kind of natural immunity. But this instead goes in and out of I don't want to call it remission, but it goes in and out of being active. No one knows. And this could go on for decades before it killed them. Anyhow, because people were so terrified, rightly, of dying or having their loved ones dying. They were trying to find causes. I think it was 1892, after the discovery of the bacteria, there was one doctor who was still insist on things like tuberculosis is caused by drunkenness and want.
And poverty. Yeah. They always blame the poor.
They always blame the poor.
Yeah.
Please, just be less poor. That's what I would do in your situation.
You were spending time with the poor, weren't you?
You know, they mingle with the poor.
You know who else mingled with the poor?
Hmm.
Jesus Christ.
I'm a fan of the book.
Yep. Yeah, he's famous for that.
He's famous, it's yeah, true. For that, amongst many other things.
Other things too, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. And people were praying. People were seeking spiritual protection in the face of, let's see, not just tubercular consumption, excuse me, but cholera, smallpox, yellow fever, measles, influenza, and then just straight up plague.
There is a, I think, kind of common misconception that I've also held with New England of this time, too, that when you say spiritual protection, I think we all think kind of, you know, standard Protestant Christian kind of practices and beliefs. But there is also a whole lot of gray area to that. And there is a whole lot of other sort of traditions from the old world and maybe some sort of new world traditions that get mixed into that. And there's really folk magic.
Yes.
There's a lot of folk magic practice. You see it in all the way back in the 1600s throughout the Salem witch trials. And again, here in the vampire panic.
Mm. Yeah, you do. And it's strange because folklore is probably best described as a conversation between cultures at these points or various points in history. And you can see it in Appalachia later. You can see it anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Some practice of what would be called folk magic. And to be clear, we're not saying that in a dismissive way. We're saying that these are practices, values, and belief systems that maybe aren't treated with the same dogma of an organized religion.
Well, they don't come from an official source, right?
Right.
There's no one in the clergy that's telling you to hang a horseshoe upside down above your door to keep, you know, ward off evil spirits or, you know, leave your boots face up by the fire. Or did they burn their boots?
Well, it depends on what's going on.
Depends. There was a thing with boots and the fireplace and keeping the devil away.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah. You know, they're not going to say that to you in church.
Right.
You know, during the sermon. But, you know, someone might come up to you afterwards, be like, you know, if you're really having an issue with the devil, maybe pop those boots off tonight.
Can it be anybody's boots? And they go, it's probably better if it's yours.
I took off my boots as soon as we got in the studio.
It's true. Are those boots?
Yeah, bro.
Oh, nice.
They're these Australian boots. Well, if I say the name, do you think they sponsor us?
Maybe give it a shot.
They're called Blundstones. I've had a lot of boots, man, they're tough.
Yeah, this is not planned as an ad, but I do want to say in Alex's defense, we were hanging out at our favorite local bar, which is, again, longtime listeners call it The Local, and I had asked him about his boots, and then we went, like you told me about them, kind of in detail, because I was looking for a good pair of boots.
I think I put them on the table.
Yeah, I think you propped a foot up at
least. Dude, my girlfriend turned me on to him. She had a pair of these. We took them to the Petrified Forest. We accidentally went off trail and stepped in some cook from the prehistoric age.
Oh, wow.
You know, killed some burgeoning life forms.
Yeah.
It's still stuck to those shoes, but man, they're about as tough as you can get.
That's awesome.
Blundstone, right. My name is Alex Williams. I host a show called Ephemeral. I would love to get a sponsorship going on.
I'd also love to be sponsored by not maybe early New England, but vampires. If you're out there, if you're listening to this show.
There are apparently, and this isn't really all that surprising, but there's a segment of the population that, like, in some capacity, in surveys, responds that they are vampires.
Yes, different types of vampires too, right?
Real vampires.
Oh, like I must drink blood. I must drink blood.
Yeah. Not just people that affect a vampire lifestyle, but people that consider themselves to actually be vampires.
Yeah, I've heard of this. There are a couple documentaries about people like this. On the more extreme end, there will be people who claim that they also cannot eat conventional sustenance, or they can't eat conventional food or drink.
You ever drank blood before, Ben?
Yes, of course.
How much? Like, I've sucked that, you know, like, you know, cut my, you know, got a cut or something on my, you know,
yeah,
on my own body.
Okay.
And you know, sure. Drained a little blood, you know.
Yeah.
Salty irony.
Uh-huh.
I mean, what's the largest quantity of blood you think you ever... Or if you got something in your, you know, you got a tooth that gets messed up, you get blood in your mouth.
Sure, yeah.
You floss one time.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Well, I am not going to answer any more questions about that experience.
I guess it is a pretty taboo subject, right? Like, if you were into that, how many people do you think you could talk to about it?
Probably, you know what? Maybe not everybody, but the people you could talk to about it would be a very passionate community. They would want to share those stories, right?
The X-Files has a great episode with vampires. I'm sure they have more than one, but there's one where it's like three kind of young, sexy vampires like living together, and they've got some kind of menage a trois-esque relationship.
Like heavily implied.
Yeah, and they've got drama. Mm-hmm. But I feel like there's the lead that kind of, you know, has this also sort of sexual energy going on with Mulder is like describing how savory and fulfilling drinking blood is.
Yeah, that's the idea of the seductive powers of a vampire is, I don't know how, it's definitely not as prevalent in early New England as it is today, right? Like today you've got the Twilight vampire. Today you've got, you know, the seductive vampire. And it's funny because it goes into another thing kind of unrelated. They're often very like sensual words are in print and in speech used to describe two things, sex and food. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
How decadent, luscious, that kind of stuff. And it makes sense that she's describing this character that you're talking about in X-Files is describing essentially was eating in very sensual terms.
But that's not what the vampires are like in the vampire pandemic in New England at all. They're much more, honestly, they're much more like zombies.
Yes. Yeah, there's this idea that, so the idea of what we call the vampire first appears in Slavic Europe around the 10th century. There have been plenty of other human-like monsters drinking blood, but, you know, good old vamps started in Slavic Europe. And according to Bell, who we mentioned earlier, his argument is that Slavic and Germanic immigrants brought those superstitions of vampires with them in the 1700s, maybe around the time a specific group from Germany was colonizing Pennsylvania, or maybe Hessian mercenaries, right? And he thinks that you can't pin it down to like one family coming through town and saying, whoa, I remember these from the old country. You've got vampires. He argues that it probably came from more than one time through more than one source, which makes sense to me because it feels like corroboration then, right? You've got multiple people who are seemingly confirming, oh yeah, vampires. That's way different from one person going, I think it's vampires, because somebody else in town walks up and goes, someone say vampires? I agree.
It's kind of, I don't want to get too far ahead of it, but it's even further complicated by like, well, who was used in contemporaneously, who was using the term vampire?
Mm-hmm.
You know, was it just the media, which is what it seems like? It was mostly a word that was used in media of the time, but not maybe so much in individual accounts.
Right.
And what were they thinking of when they said vampire, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing. It's what's in a word. What did the word vampire mean to them versus to us today? And I agree that it's much more like the modern idea of a zombie.
If I may.
Yes.
If I could explain it to you and you tell me if I've got it right.
Okay.
We're in a family, the Williams, Ben, Bolin, Lowell, Brillante, Ridiculous History family.
Mm-hmm.
Like we are here in this little studio together.
Yeah.
And Lowell, great producer as he is, gets sick with consumption, we do our best. We send him to a sanitarium. We send him to Colorado Springs. He seems like he's going to get better. He doesn't. He gets all skinny and he's foaming and mm-hmm. he's got blood coming out and he's not doing well. He's staying up weird hours of the night. We're like weirded out by him. And then one day it's mercifully over.
I swear it's just allergies.
I forget those
were those were his last words. Oh, poor Lowell.
And too so it's like, world. You know, yeah. The mid-1700s, late-1700s. We want to bury him in the ground, have a nice Christian funeral, but the ground is frozen.
Right.
We stick this guy in an above-ground tomb in a box. We have the pastor come, say a few nice words, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Mm-hmm. And we go on with the rest of our lives, you know, missing Lowell all the while.
Right.
But then Ben gets sick.
I do.
And the same symptoms are happening, the same weird stuff. His cheeks are getting flushed. His like eyes are sunken in.
Even more than usual.
He's like coughing and he's starting to cough blood.
I fear I've lost my appetite.
We sent him to the Adirondacks to upstate New York because we've got all the money to send people to all the sanitariums.
Yeah,
I go along too, bring the Blundstones, break them in. but Ben's not getting better. Everything we try, we take him to the best doctors who do like leeches and bloodletting and whatever. We take him to all the best doctors and it's not working.
Yeah.
And I've tried everything. I want so badly to save my guest co-host. Mm. So I guess I'm your guest co-host, but whatever. And I'm, you know, people in town start saying to me, you know what it is, right?
Right.
I mean, you know why you can't. It's because Lowell over there in the ground is exercising his will from beyond the grave on mm-hmm. Ben. He's literally getting out of the corpse is getting out of the grave or out of the tomb at night, probably when no one's looking, and coming and preying upon you.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it more of a psychic kind of spiritual way that it's, you know, he's somehow projecting himself onto you. And so is it physical? Is it mm-hmm. spiritual, spectral?
So this is interesting because this is where we get to the, first off, excellent rendition.
Thank you.
10-10.
I've got it. That's more or less the
yes,
idea, right?
That is exactly the idea. And people back then were just as intelligent as people are now. They didn't have access to the same level of research or the same like knowledge of medicine that modern folks have, but they weren't knuckleheads. You know, there were plenty of skeptical people who would say, all right, well, that's malarkey. But then there were also people who would say, maybe I believe in an afterlife, so maybe this is another part of it that I am not aware of. And there were people who believed that they were mentally or through some incorporeal form, they were traveling to their victims, drawn by their life force and the fact that they had known one another in the waking world. Or like the big question, if you're a skeptical at all, is if someone is physically rising from the grave, why is the grave not disturbed, right? That was one of the big questions. And we see accusations of vampirism in other parts of history when someone had been prematurely buried, which becomes a huge concern, I think, in Victorian times especially. Just check out the inventions people made with the little I'm not dead bells. That's what I call them. But I think he nailed it because even if you're more skeptical at this point, if you're surrounded by death, you've lost multiple people in your community, you've lost more than one family member, and you think more might be on the way, maybe your last healthy kid isn't looking so healthy, mm-hmm. then you start to say, I don't know, maybe I'll try anything.
And if you, and it's a really good point that people haven't been all that different at any point in time, right?
Not really, no.
You know, it's a crazy story, a crazy collection of stories, but you go and you try to look at it empathetically. And and this comes from Bell too, but I mean, you know, imagine the father who's tried everything for his last ailing kid and is like, I guess I'll try this crazy thing. I'll dig up my dead wife.
And this is where we get to the grisly, strange, all too real stories. We're actually going to make this a two-parter because Alex Lowell and I really want to, well, dig into the grave of it. Sounds insensitive, but we do want to give some real examples, and we want to spend some time here. So we're going to pause, and we'll be back very soon with part two of the New England Vampire Panic. In the meantime, I don't think I've ever done this before, but thank you to Alex Williams. Thank you to Lowell Brillante. Alex, you are going to come back for the second part of this, right?
I want to. I want to very much. Very much?
Close, yeah, not bad. Lowell, are you on board to come back? I think you nailed it with that allergies line.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Hey, let me see if you can guess this one. We'll go out because we promised some bad jokes. Hey, Alex, why does Dracula always read the most popular newspapers?
Why does Dracula always read the most popular newspapers? I don't know, Ben. Why does he?
Because he likes the ones with good circulation.
All right. Well, we hope that you've weathered that one, and you too.
And we hope you enjoyed this, Ridiculous Historians. We hope you tune in to part two of this. Big, big thanks, Alex Williams. Big, big thanks to Lowell Brillante. Big thanks to Max Williams. Big thanks to my ride or die co-host, Noel Brown, who will be returning soon. And big thanks to Gabe Lousier. Alex, where can people find Ephemeral?
And like all of the social medias, it's at ephemeral.show on Instagram. I think some of them don't have the dot. And then our website is www.ephemeral.show.
All right. And Lowell, where can people find Prodigy?
Wherever they listen to their favorite shows.
All right. Well, with no spoilers, then please do check out both Prodigy and Ephemeral. Stay safe, folks. We will talk very soon. In the meantime, let us know what your Halloween ideas are. Can't wait to hear from you.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.